Nice to be back myself. I'm a stand-in tonight. It was Sina Pia last week introduced us to the symbol of the stupa. Introduced us to the symbol of the stupa, which is what this picture on the shrine represents. And he was going to continue this week, but he's not well. So I've just today arrived back from retreat in Spain, and so I'm standing in to talk to you a bit more about the stupa. But since I am just back from retreat, I've got some news for you, because I'm just back from the women's ordination retreat at Akashavana. There's also a men's ordination retreat happening at Guhiloka just now. And four women from the LBC have just been ordained. And kind of more or less as we speak today, two men from the LBC are getting ordained. But I have for you the women's names. I thought you might like to hear. Some of you will know them. So I thought I could just announce that first of all. So some of you might know Helen Burgess. So Helen, she's particularly at the centre here. She's helped to found and also in running the under 35s group, and she actually has now become the youngest Dharmacharini in the West, and her name has become Kusala Sara, which means she whose strength is in being skillful. So we have one new order member called Kusala Sara. Then some of you, if you ever go to Lama's Pajamas, you might know Claudine Edwards, or she who was Claudine Edwards, who founded Lama's Pajamas. And her name has become Abhayanandi, and that means she who delights in fearlessness. And also helping out at Lama's Pajamas from time to time has been Carol Edwards, and she's become Jyoti Kari, she who cultivates the light of intelligence, freedom and victory. And Anne Cronin, who I know some of you know very well, and who works in Jambala Bookshop, she has become Mahamani, she who has the great and precious jewel. Yeah, so that's four new order members with four new names. So order members' names are given to them by their private preceptors, and they're given as, the names are like a Dharma teaching really, and they're also something to aspire to, and they're also something where there's already a resonance. So all these people, the private preceptors, have chosen their names because of qualities that we see as kind of in them already, but which they can, as they continue in the Dharma practice, develop even more. And the names are also like an anchor for them, that they can remember that they were witnessed in that moment of committing to the Dharma. So in a few weeks' time, those women, although I'm back from the retreat, they're still on their three-month retreat. And in a few weeks' time, they'll be coming here to this class to just talk to us and just kind of be with us and, you know, just share with us some of that experience of being the newest order members. And then a week or two later, the men will come back and they'll do the same. We'll have the men's names soon. They'll just be being announced just now. Yeah, so I just thought I'd share that, being just back myself. It was a very lovely time being with them on retreat, and they were all very well. And Akashavana, our women's ordination centre, is really very, very wild, beautiful place. It's very remote. It's particularly known for the vultures that fly overhead. And if you lie down still enough, you can kind of draw them down, sort of circling around you. But apparently they've got good enough eyesight to see that you're breathing, so they don't come right down. And also wild ibex, which are these like lovely, light-footed kind of goats, but, you know, very... very dainty goats, it's very mountainous. And I'm sure Guhiloka, which I've never been, because it's a men's retreat centre, is equally as beautiful, where the men are. Nyanavacha is still there just now with the ordinations. Okay, so that's just a little announcement. Another announcement, which I might forget to say at the end, is that next week, Padma Vadra, who's already been a guest at this class twice already, which is they're talking about the symbols of the Tantra, is coming for part three. So, yes, I really recommend coming along next week and hearing Padma Vadra. If you haven't heard him already, he is... one of our most senior order members in our movement, and lives at Pamiloka, the men's retreat centre, so is coming as a guest. Okay, so that's all the news. So now we're going to carry on with the symbol of the stupa, another one of our tantric symbols. It actually is a symbol that kind of predates the Tantra. The Tantra of Vajrayana is the third great phase of Buddhism. The stupa goes right back to the time of the Buddha. Silapi will have said a bit of this already, so some of it will be a recap. So a stupa originally was a burial mound or reliquary, and it goes right back to the time of the Buddha. When the Buddha knew he was going to pass away, his disciples said, "Well, what will we do with your remains after your cremation?" And in answer, the Buddha folded his robe into a little square or cube and put it down, and then turned his begging bowl upside down. And that became the base of what we now call a stupa. And we have stupas on this shrine. I'm sure, again, Sinapia may have shown you these last week. So these kind of wooden and golden, and I put one in the middle, ceramic, forms are... Inside these forms are the ashes of order members who have died. So they're inside these stupas. And they're quite small stupas. In the east, you'd have big, gigantic sort of monuments. And over here, propped on the chair, is a painting of the stupa. So it's become more and more stylized. So this original just folded robe into a rough cube, upturned begging bowl into a hemisphere, has become more and more stylized. And particularly in the one I put in the middle, that kind of shows the sort of more sort of stylized form most clearly. So this is a stupa of our well-loved order member called Vidya Jyoti, and she was an order member for many years at the center here. She died a few years ago. And she was an artist, so she's got this very sort of splendid ceramic stupa. So the base is a cube, and then you've got this sphere on top, and then you've got this cone shape next, then a saucer shape, and then what the top's representing is a flaming drop. Yeah. And then in the picture, you've got the stupa painted in its more traditional colours. So more traditionally, the cube would be yellow, and the sphere would be, is it white there? White or blue? White. Thank you very much, yeah. And then the cone...
Yeah, good idea.
Oh yeah, thank you. I was struggling to prop it up without it going flying. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. The cone red... and the saucer shape green, and then the flaming drop iridescent coloured. So that's the symbol. And again, as with all these symbols, because a symbol by its very nature is multifaceted, it's something you can explore at deeper and deeper levels, it's something that will reveal its meaning to you more and more over time. We're going to, you could spend a whole week or a whole retreat or a whole series just on the symbol. So I'm just going to go through it in some way. And I might be overlapping some of what Silapia said last week, but hopefully you won't mind. And again, I'm using this book, Creative Symbols of Tantric Buddhism by Sangharakshita. So, in time, the sort of shape of the stupa came to be very, very associated with the five elements, the so-called five elements. So these five elements, earth, water, fire, air and space, yeah? So each of the shapes represents one of the elements. But I just want to say a bit about these elements, first of all, because it's not what we... It might not be exactly what they seem. So the first four elements, earth, water, fire and air. So the elements, it's not like elements of the periodic table, it's elements in a much more symbolic way than that. Earth, water, fire and air. And make up what we call the material universe. Bhante says the so-called material universe. And in all the schools of Buddhism, these are collectively known as rupa. Rupa, R-U-P-A. And early translators of Buddhism into Western languages, well, in a way they had to... I mean, I've never tried to translate another language. It must be very difficult because it's not, words don't just map onto another thing. It's almost like those original translators had to feel their way through a new landscape, a new thought world. Yeah, that's what they found themselves in. And they translated rupa, wherever they encountered it, as matter. Yeah. And they thought it meant matter as opposed to mind. I mean, in a way, you can probably forgive them, because in a way, as I say, they were having to feel their way into just quite a different system of thought. But Bhante says this can be very misleading. What rupa literally means is form. Form. Although that translation can be misleading too. So there's a scholar called Dr. Guthner, and what he's translated, and this is, it sounds a bit abstract, but this is more like it. So although it sounds abstract at first, listen on. So he's called it the objective content of the perceptual situation. Yeah. So what he means by that is we kind of say quite commonly, oh, I had such and such an experience, yeah. I saw the sky and it was blue or something, yeah. But what is more accurate to say is that there is a situation in which perception takes place, yeah. So whenever we perceive something, so that might be through sight, like we see a flower, or it might be we hear a tune, we can distinguish two elements of that perceptual situation. So first of all, there's what we ourselves contribute to it. So there's the sensation mediated through our sense faculties, yeah? And whatever feelings, either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, arrive as a result. We've already studied that quite a lot in this class, how perception will always be accompanied by that feeling tone, yeah? It'll always be pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. But in that perceptual situation, there's something we don't contribute, something that the experience seems to be an experience of, doesn't there? Something to which the perceptual situation seems to refer. And that something, unknown and unidentified, is the object of content of that perceptual situation or experience. So it's that Buddhism calls rupa, yeah? So rupa is not, it's definitely not matter as opposed to mind, because that mind-matter dualism doesn't exist in Buddhism. It doesn't exist in the Tantra especially. So I'll carry on for a bit, because I don't want us to get too abstract here, which is what it could be in danger of. So this might sort of fill it out a bit more. So we'll experience rupa in certain ways. So there's four main ways we'll experience rupa, and this corresponds to these shapes in the stupa. So we perceive rupa as solid and resistant, yeah? We'll experience it, or we'll experience it as fluid and cohesive, yeah? We'll experience it as possessing a certain temperature, or we'll experience it as light and moving. And those four qualities are what we're symbolizing by the elements of earth, water, fire, and air. So when we're saying earth, water, fire, and air, we're talking about those things as symbols, not as things. So we're talking about earth as a symbol. We're not saying earth is this lump of rock or this metal bell. It's rather, we're saying earth is what is perceived of as solid and resistant, yeah? So I can't put my hand through it, yeah? So that's more, that's what we're talking about more, yeah? And when we're talking about water, we're not talking about, oh yeah, we turn on the tap and like the stuff comes out, or we like lift our cup to our lips and drink some tea, yeah? It's more is what is perceived of as fluid, yeah, and sort of takes the shape of whatever it's poured into, yeah. So that's water as a symbol rather than literal H2O, yeah. And then by whatever is perceived of as possessing temperature is symbolized by fire. Yeah, so again, it's not a literal fire. And whatever is perceived of as possessing lightness and mobility is symbolized by air. So again, when we say air, we don't just mean literal air that we breathe. It's that quality, of movement, of wind, you know, of that movement. So that hopefully helps us for a start if we think of them in terms of qualities. So these four qualities, earth, water, air and fire, are known as Mahabhutas. This means great or primary element. And yeah, they're the basis, yeah? And This might help us to know that Mahabhuta also refers to sometimes great magical transformations, such as when a magician makes you see one thing, makes you see something, like makes you see a gold where there was only clay, yeah? So our experience of rupa, for example, is similar. So we come up against an experience of resistance, yeah? We don't really know what that is. We don't really know, even if we've studied physics and all the rest of it, we don't really know. In a sense, we can't know, but we call it earth. We call it earth element, yeah? Even though it's still a mystery to us, and it's, in a way, Buddhism would say it's good that it's still a mystery to us, yeah? So, and that's what is represented in the first four shapes in the stupa, yeah? So, you've got this square at the bottom, this cube. So that is representing earth element. So that sort of resistance, that fixedness, that solidity, yeah? And then the sphere is representing water element. Yeah, that fluidity, that sort of the way that water element flows, you know, takes the shape. It isn't resistant. It takes the shape of whatever vessel it's poured into. And then the cone shape is fire. You can see how each one, it's as if each one is upwardly moving, got more energy, more freed up energy than the one before. So you've got earth, solid, resistant, fixed, sort of bounded in shape, and then you've got water, fluid, so it's more freely moving. And then you've got fire, which is more freely moving, again represented by this red cone, and then air, which is completely freely moving, and that's represented by that saucer shape. So I want to say something about the flaming drop in a minute, but what, is there anything, any questions on what I've said so far? About these four sort of elements as symbols. Does it sort of make sense, at least in theory, this distinction between literal earth and earth as a symbol?
I remember seeing
a... Sorry, can you talk a little bit louder, Eileen?
I remember looking up a stupa before, and it came in yellow, white, red and black.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if...
Yeah, well, probably there's different colours. So was it black, the air element? That's interesting, isn't it? I've never heard of that, but it's... I mean, in a way, these colours are just symbols as well, but I'm more familiar with the with green being the air element, yeah. Anything else? Can people relate to the that sort of notion of the sort of energy becoming more sort of free and unbounded as we kind of rise up, as we as it were? I don't know if you've been quiet because it's also it all feels obvious to you, or if there's.
Could the fire element represent something that's very very cool and very cold?
Yeah, it could. Yeah, yeah. So that's quite, and again, I think that's quite a good way of thinking of it, that it's not literal fire, it's anything with temperature. Yeah, yeah. So it's temperature either way. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And in a way, everything we experience has temperature. Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll say a wee bit about this flaming drop, and then we're going to do a little meditation after that. So the flaming drop is the space element, yeah? And so space is different from the other elements. Space is not rupa. Space is not form. Space is that which contains all the other four elements, yeah? It's what makes earth, water, fire and air possible. It's what makes possible the existence of the whole material universe. So the word translated as space, we've come across this before in this class, is akasha. And if you met Akasha Mitra, who's here at this class, that word is in his name. And it comes from the root kash, meaning to shine. So there's a kind of light that's not the light from any external source, the sun, the moon, the stars. It's a more... It's a light where you might see in meditation, for example. I mean, often, I don't know if you have this, but often when I imagine the Buddha, and if I'm meditating, I'm imagining the Buddha. At first, it's as if, it's like first when I look at the Buddha in my mind's eye, I see his historical form, a figure under a tree, a man meditating. But it's as if the longer one looks at that form, the more it shines, yeah? So in my meditation, on a good day, my meditation will be filled with that light, which is the light of the Buddha. So that this word kash from akasha is that kind of light. And we might see it more ordinarily. I mean, as I said, I've just been on the ordination retreat, seeing 15 women become ordained and seeing other women ordaining them. And many, many of those women were shining. One of them in particular, like, literally did seem to have a glow coming from her. But probably if you took an actual literal photograph, you wouldn't, well, I imagine, unless you were very sensitive, you wouldn't see that light, yeah? But, you know, but being with her, you could see that light. You might have noticed it yourself on retreat. People seem to start to shine. So that's the kind of light that is meant when we talk about the kash, as in akasha. It's not light that's coming from a light bulb. It's light that you might see in meditation. And Bhante says we all have direct experience of akasha as well, this kind of space. That's not, it's not sort of literal Newtonian space. It's space in the sense of that that's illuminated by that light, yeah? So it's on a quite simple level, it's when you see something in your mind's eye, yeah? It occupies space, doesn't it? But it's not that literal space. So, you know, you could ask yourself, where is that space? If I ask you just to imagine someone, you'd be able to get a sense of them. But where are they? You know, where is that space? So another teacher called Lama Govinda, he says that our inner visionary experience, and when I'm saying visionary, it's not with a capital V, I mean it might be, but just that ordinary, being able to see someone in your mind's eye, takes place, that visionary experience takes place within an inner imaginal space, yeah? So there's a sort of distinction between two orders of reality here. So there's the literal space that we open our eyes and see, and then there's this imaginal space, yeah? And once we begin to accommodate this idea of imaginal space, we begin to see that the things that we habitually experience as being out there are perhaps not so much out there or so concretely existent as we like to think. That doesn't mean they're non-existent. Yeah, it definitely doesn't mean they're non-existent. There is experience, for sure, but where that experience is happening is perhaps not so cut and dried as we might imagine, yeah? So this akasha is represented by the flaming drop, yeah? So again, yeah, maybe if you just remember one thing about akasha, remember it's not so much the literal space that you open your eyes and see, but it's the space that you close your eyes and experience, especially in meditation, I think. Sometimes when you close your eyes in meditation, something opens up, doesn't it? And it's like the inner space becomes very, very big, you know. Again, on a good day, perhaps, but something, yeah, you can, there even is a meditative state called the sphere of infinite space, yeah, something unbounded. You get a sense of something unbounded, and that's more like akasha. And that's represented by this flame and drop. So that's something even more mysterious again. So I think what this symbol of the stupa is trying to point us to is that we think we know what earth, water, air, fire, even space is. But what the stupa is saying is what we think we know is very limited. It's only that one dimension of what they really are. There's really much more to these elements than we think. They're more mysterious. Perhaps it's a start if we start to think of them in terms of energy. But even that's only a start. So is there anything else on that? It's about anything about Akasha. Do people, does that sort of resonate, that sort of inner space that you experience when you meditate? Yeah? There's kind of an illuminated space. You've got that kind of, the light and the space as one thing, really. Okay, is there anything else to say before we move on to the next bit? Okay, what we're going to do for the rest of the evening is we're going to do a little meditation, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe it first, so we won't sit in our meditation posture just yet. So it'll sound very simple, the meditation we're going to do, but it's quite a strong meditation in many ways. We're going to reflect on the earth element, both within us and outside us. And although it seems simple, what I want you to remember is that this evening we've already done a whole practice of the Metta Bhavana, those of us that were here for the first half. I'm sure Padmadara does the Metta Bhavana all the time anyway. And then a period of just sitting. So we're doing this little reflection on top of that. So I want to urge you that if you wanted to formally do this reflection again, to, even though it might seem simple, to always do it having done a full-length Metta Bhavana first, yeah? Okay, that's important. Yeah, that's important. Because with these kind of reflections, there's always a danger of nihilism, and that's absolutely what Buddhism is not. So we want to always do these reflections on the back of or on the front rather, of a heart that's warmed by metta. Yeah. So what we're going to do, and I'll lead us through when we come to do it, is we're going to consider the earth element both within our body and outside our body. So we have earth element. So we have, we experience the earth element quite strongly in ourselves. In its individual parts, like we've, you know, we experience our teeth, you know, kind of quite, we can actually feel our teeth. We can feel, we get a sense of our bones. We can feel, like, for example, one hand on each other. That's earth. That's us experiencing the resistance of earth element. You know, our hand isn't just merging with our other hand. It's actually, you know, this earth, yeah? We can feel that we are upright. You know, we're not just kind of dissolving into a pool. You know, we're, the uprightness of us is earth element. So first of all, we're going to, in this little meditation, we're going to feel that, really feel it as fully as possible in ourselves. And then we're going to experience it outside ourselves. So perhaps maybe in our most immediate surroundings, we can feel the actual contact with the floor. Again, we can feel that the floor is resisting us. You know, we're not going through it. We can feel our cushions. Perhaps taking it a bit wider, we can feel that, you know, we're enclosed by walls. You know, I don't know if it's still raining outside, but even if it is, you know, that's not coming in on us because we're enclosed by walls. So we can feel that. So we really feel that. When I say reflection, so that can be a bit misleading. We're not trying to think about these things with our brain. We're really feeling those. And then we can start to sort of experience that there's a constant exchange between those things. The so-called inside and the so-called outside aren't as hard and fast as we Well, they're not hard and fast, are they? We kind of eat food, we take the earth element in, and it also passes out of us. You know, we cut our nails and our hair, they grow back. And not only that, it's quite mysterious. I mean, even if we know quite a lot about science, it's still mysterious. You know, we sort of roughly know, well, if we eat more food, we'll get bigger, and if we eat less, we'll get smaller. But, you know, we don't really know how that food we eat turns into bones and hair and teeth and stuff like that. We can't... It just sort of happens, you know. We don't will it to happen. We're not making it happen or stopping it happen. We've got a little bit of control over it, but not much. So we can just reflect on that exchange, and I think the most helpful way to reflect on that exchange is to reflect on it in a sense that it's a benign exchange. I once spent a whole solitary retreat doing this practice in a bit of a nihilistic way. I got a bit depressed by the end of it. I was kind of thinking, oh yeah, the earth element. It's just earth. It doesn't care about me. It just comes in me and out me, and then one day it'll go completely. Honestly, by the end of the retreat, I was a bit of a sorry state, as you can imagine. So I wouldn't recommend, you know, you could do it in that kind of rather scientific, cold way. But since we don't really know anything about anything, why not imagine the earth as a benign earth, which is, you know, sort of willingly sort of giving this element to us, you know. So the earth, why not imagine the earth element as something that's been sort of given to us to help us and that will be with us for as long as we need it, yeah, which it will. It'll be with us as long as we need it. So we try and reflect on it in a friendly way, yeah, as if the earth element outside was lending itself to us, yeah, for as long as we need it. It'll be there as long as we need it. As long as we've got use for it, it'll be there, yeah? So this is a reflection that the Buddha taught. So we'll do that for a few minutes, and then we'll just let go of the reflection, yeah? So, and then I'll ask you how you got on. So just sit up. Or maybe I'll just not be on during this. Yeah, turn off. Yeah.